Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we have probably our most requested guest we ever have for the program, who's here often, but usually only in a fundraising capacity. Today, we've got her for the whole hour just to talk about politics and journalism and media. Our guest today, Amy Goodman, joining us. But first, before we go to Amy Goodman, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Most internet users are familiar with targeted advertising, like the ads that pop up alongside your search results. But one online advertising firm called Nebuad may have stepped over the line with its ad targeting scheme. Nebuad monitors web browsing activities and alters the computer codes of websites, all without the user's knowledge. Rob Topolsky is the author of a new report on Nebuad.
Nebuad is different from traditional ad networks because Nebuad enjoys a uniquely perfect perspective because it's installed on the inside of your internet service provider's network. From that position, it can see everything that you see and everything that you do on the internet.
Unlike traditional web advertising, Nebuad monitors everything on a page and every page, whether it has been invited to do so or not. And it sees not only the generic content, but personalized content, too. And because Nebuad is installed inside the ISP's network, users can't really opt out of the program. Topolsky's report has caught the attention of Congress. In a letter to Charter Communications, a large ISP that has announced plans to test Nebuad, Representatives Edward Markey and Joe Barton questioned the legality of the technology and asked ISPs to stop using Nebuad until Congress had a chance to study the issue. Charter postponed its testing, and other ISPs are beginning to follow suit. Topolsky has identified 10 ISPs using Nebuad, which he's listed in the Nebuad entry on Wikipedia.
Sunshine makes the best disinfectant, and so getting it out there is a good thing. But then I immediately think, here's another 200, 300, 400,000 users whose information that they think is being kept private is being sold by their ISP. Everybody that I describe this to has the same reaction. This should be illegal. And the question that policymakers and debaters in Washington, D.C. are trying to determine is it illegal? And if it's not, what do we need to do in order to make it so?
Philadelphia's attempt to create the country's largest municipal wireless broadband system was once held up as a national model. But in May, the city's partner in the effort, Earthlink, announced it was abandoning the project. 2 weeks ago, Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter announced an agreement with a group of local investors who've come together as Network Acquisition Company to take over the system. Although community organizers welcomed the news, it's unclear how the new deal will accomplish the original goal of the Wi-Fi project, to bring the benefits of high-speed internet access to all residents. Beth McConnell is the executive director of the Media and Democracy Coalition and a Philadelphia resident.
The original vision of the system was a wireless system that worked both indoors and outdoors throughout the entire city. The new vision of the system is different. The new company, NAC, isn't aiming its sights on the average consumer. It's aiming its sights on businesses that need wired DSL internet service and would like their employees to be able to continue to have access once they leave the office.
The obvious downside is that an outdoor connection isn't always what residents need.
You're trying to do your homework and it's raining outside, or you're trying to apply for a job and you can't pick up the signal in your home, or it's cold and you need access to the internet. An outdoor signal doesn't really solve that problem.
New technologies are emerging to make the outdoor signals stronger and faster, but there's a limit to what can be done with the type of spectrum that's being used.
But really what will make wireless systems like this work well and compete with cable and DSL and fiber is if the FCC opens up better quality spectrum.
Wi-Fi operates on so-called junk bands, which are crowded with everything from baby monitors to microwave ovens. The signals are weak and can't penetrate through walls and other obstacles. There's better spectrum out there, McConnell says, that's going unused. It's the vacant airwaves in between broadcast TV signals.
What we would really like to see is the FCC make the TV white spaces, as it's called, available for unlicensed use so that smart devices that are in research and development right now would be able to access this better quality spectrum. So if the FCC allowed that spectrum to be used by local community groups or municipal governments or even, you know, for-profit entrepreneurs to offer high-quality Wi-Fi access, a system like the one that we have here in Philadelphia would have been much more successful.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, we have a terrific guest for you, someone that is probably our most popular guest, someone who needs not a huge introduction to most of our listeners, but we'll give one nonetheless. Amy Goodman is a distinguished journalist, the host and founder of Democracy Now!, the radio and television program now showing incredibly enough, on 700 radio and television stations in the United States and worldwide. She's the author of several books, including most recently with her brother, David Goodman, the book Standing Up to the Madness, Outstanding Heroes in Extraordinary Times. It's a privilege and an honor to welcome Amy Goodman to Media Matters. Amy?
It's great to be with you, Bob. Great to be with all the listeners.
And, you know, again, I just want to thank you. And our listeners hear your voice on this program twice a year, and they have now for several years, because you take time from your extraordinary schedule to come on every time we do a pledge drive. When I asked you to do this show, in fact, you said, gee, is it a pledge drive? Like you wanted to raise money for WILL and for this
program. I need the number. I got to pitch that number. But no matter what happens, if we don't get pitched today, folks, make sure you honor your pledge or pledge early for the next one.
Oh, thank you so much, Amy. Well, let's talk. You know, I think one of the there's so much to talk about. I want to talk about your book. I want to talk about what's going on in the world today, the state of media and journalism. But I think the place that's one of the really interesting stories out there that's not talked about a lot, but it's recognized, is the emergence and growth of Democracy Now! It's really an extraordinary story. So why don't you just, if you wouldn't mind, just give a little bit of the history of Democracy Now!, why it started, where it started, and what the growth process has been like.
We began in 1996 as the only daily election show in public broadcasting on a few dozen community radio stations. And then right around September 11th, we started broadcasting on public access TV. One station in New York wanted to put a camera in our radio studio. We broadcast out of a 100-year-old firehouse that's a landmark building that's now a community media center. And I said, as long as it doesn't interfere with the sound, if you have this camera and it links to the public access station, Manhattan Neighborhood Network. And so we started immediately. Other public access stations said, can we also run it? Now, this is news, like breaking news every day. So we FedExed it to them. Then we started going on satellite television, on Free Speech TV. That's Dish Network, Channel 9415. And the more TV stations we went on, the more radio stations would ask, oh, could we run you? And then we went on Link Television, which is 9410 on Dish Network, and it's also on DirecTV. It's on the two TV satellite networks, Channel 375 of DirecTV. And NPR stations started asking to broadcast us. PBS stations started asking to broadcast us. And now it's like a station a week. We also translate our headlines into Spanish, and about 200 stations are taking those headlines around the world. We just went on NPR in Baltimore, and it's been a tremendous success there. We began with Pacifica Radio, you know, the incredible tradition. It was really a pioneer in listener sponsorship, and then NPR adopted that. PBS adopted it, viewer sponsorship, the idea that you have a media outlet not brought to you by corporations that profit from war, but brought to you by journalists and artists. And so this community has just grown. And I really feel like at this absolutely critical juncture, when we need an independent media more than ever, we need independent media in a time of war, we are piecing together an independent media network in this country that is made up of all these different sectors that don't usually communicate with each other. You know, public access TV, community radio, Pacifica Radio, low-power stations that are coming online, NPR stations, PBS stations. You know, at a point in 2009, as everyone is required to go digital, these PBS stations will have a number of stations because you get more stations, more channels. There's more space for those channels, and they're looking for content. And it is absolutely critical that together also independent satellite television, like Free Speech and Link, that we build this network. It's very important. It's decentralized, but also very important to have a global forum for so many voices that are kept out. You know, the majority. I always say that those who are opposed to war, those who are opposed to torture, are not a fringe minority, not even a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media. So we have to challenge the corporate media, demand that they open up. You know, I was just invited on MSNBC, and using those sort of cracks in the edifice, those small openings, to provide a roadmap for people to look at independent media, also doing a column distributed by King Features every week that's in papers around the country, and your local newspaper, too, can run it. Folks just have to ask. And it's also training people in media activism. You know, we have to put the public back in public media. People can challenge the corporate media because it's not just us and public radio and television that are using the public airwaves. People must remember the networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, they're using the public airwaves as well. And that word public is the operative word, or it should be. The airwaves are a national treasure, and stations get licenses to use those airwaves. And if they don't use them responsibly, they should have those licenses revoked. When we were both, Bob, at the National Conference for Media Reform, an amazing accomplishment, and I congratulate you and Free Press and freepress.net for this incredible moment that we had in Minneapolis, or, 4 days, where over 3,000 people came out, people from every walk of life all over this country looking for a better media and not just sitting back as couch potatoes, but joining together and saying, we're going to take back our media. I spoke to Michael Copps, one of the two dissident FCC commissioners, the other one, Jonathan Adelstein of the Five. And Michael Copps said, we have to make the licensing process. You know, often these TV networks or stations go up for licensing maybe every 3 years, or it depends on the area. Make them meaningful. If they're not serving the community should be there saying this and challenge their licenses. But the media is our last hope. This is not just an academic exercise. It is the place we talk to each other. If we don't know each other personally, it's the place where ideas are formed. As Noam Chomsky says, the place where the media manufactures consent. Too often it is for war. And that all has to be challenged. And the way it's challenged is simply by opening it up, by breaking the sound barrier, by letting the public in.
Amy Goodman, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We recorded this program shortly before going on air, so please don't call. Just sit back, relax, and let Amy and me do all the talking. Amy, about 3 weeks ago, we had Jeremy Scahill as our guest on Media Matters, a wonderful program, and he described the way he got started in journalism. And he said basically he was listening to Democracy Now! Over a radio station in Washington, D.C., and he was so taken by it, he just came and volunteered for you. And he described when he first went to your office, I think in New York City, that you, but what he described in effect is a windowless closet.
Yes, it was.
And that, you know, he said that he was basically educated in the Juan Gonzalez, Amy Goodman School of Journalism. That's really, he learned the craft from the two of you. And I say that because it goes to the point you were just making about how important it is for people to learn how to do this by doing it, but also because it's quite striking compared to where you are today, because I've been on your program recently at the Minneapolis conference you referred to just last month. And now we're talking about a real significant exponential increase in sort of the size of personnel and resources and professionalism of the operation.
Yeah, I mean, the show has really grown now on over 700 stations. And it means it has a much greater reach. More and more people contact us. It's the way we learn about stories. Every place I go, you know, I travel a great deal. And every place I go, it's also listening. It's meeting people who are truly remarkable, and they are the future guests on our shows. Everyone from, I was at the Book Expo America. You know, that is the independent booksellers of mm-hmm. this country. And they are very important. We don't often think of them as part of the independent media landscape, but they are critical. In fact, at the National Conference on Media Reform, the bookseller there for all of the authors who were there was Birchbark Books, a wonderful independent bookstore in Minneapolis. It's owned by Louise Erdrich, the great Native American writer. Her latest book is The Plague of Doves. And these are sanctuaries of dissent, just like public radio and television. And I was just talking to different booksellers there because they deeply care about being these reservoirs of information that people can't get other places, booksellers. I have just great appreciation for them. Having written three books, I've come in much more contact and learned to understand, you know, these are very mission-driven people. And one of the people there was writing a book about them, but he told me about being at St. Lawrence University 42 years ago, in 1966, when Robert F. Kennedy went to give a speech about war, totally pro-Vietnam War. And he was, you know, applied for CO status, this man who was talking to me, and he had the only recording of the speech. Now, he was pointing out, he said that it actually increased his esteem for Robert Kennedy, because 2 years later he ran as an anti-war candidate. He said it shows that these people can grow. He was expounding on his brother, John Kennedy's, you know, involvement in Vietnam, the building involvement, but he then changed his mind. And so we played the only recording of this address at St. Lawrence University in Canton, New York, on the 40th anniversary of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination. And then we had him on, he was a professor in Boston, talking about how, on the one hand, yes, it was a major pro-war speech, but on the other hand, it showed how politicians can evolve, and we rarely show that. In the same way that the media rarely shows grassroots movements, and we're very dedicated to Democracy Now, to focusing on movements, giving voice to these movements, especially for young people. How are you to understand how change happens if you think it's all on your shoulders? You know, you think, I'm no Martin Luther King, you think, I'm no Rosa Parks, I couldn't do this. They, too, came out of movements, and they inspired movements, and the media wipes out those movements, so it's very hard to understand how change happens. And so we document these movements. Just a few days ago, we had a soldier on, a sergeant, deeply moving interview. He, on Father's Day, was with his father in Washington. And he announced he would not go to war in Iraq. He'd already been a journalist, a military reporter. He had been in Afghanistan. He had been in Germany. And he said it was an immoral war. And he talked about the state of journalism. It was truly fascinating within the military. He had gone to interview a Romanian soldier. His name was Army Sergeant Mathis Chiru, who I interviewed, refusing to deploy to Iraq. It all depends on the military whether he's AWOL, absent without leave. They have to define him in that way. But he was assigned, for example, to do a story on a young Romanian soldier. These are the coalition forces that was receiving excellent care from the U.S. military. And so he went to the military hospital, Sergeant Mathis Chiru, and was doing a piece on him. What he could not say was that he was in complete isolation, this Romanian soldier, because he was suffering from a bacteria that was very commonly picked up in Afghanistan and was a big problem for the military. So he could not describe how he was in an isolation chamber. He also was not allowed to tell the story of the many other U.S. soldiers who were in the same military hospital. He said as he was leaving, he walked down the hall, and he passed a young man, not more than 19, whose arms and legs were blown off. And the soldier turned to him and said, "Are you doing a story?" He said, "Well, not on you, but on that young Romanian soldier." He said, "I want to remind you, there are 36 of us here." I think he used that number. 36 of us, and you choose to do the only person who's not a U.S. soldier who is wounded, to show what good care we give another soldier. And he said, "And it's good to do that. But what about us? What about telling our stories?" And Mathis Giroux went to his editor, and he said, "What about these other soldiers? This young man who had no arms and legs?" And she said, "That is not our mission. Part of our mission is to show how we take care of other soldiers." And he understood very well. He said, "Can I be part of a system that is propagandizing, not tell, by choosing not to tell these stories of these wounded warriors?" And that has led Mathis Giroux to refuse to deploy to Iraq. These are the stories we don't hear, like Winter Soldier, these hundreds of soldiers who gathered in Silver Spring on the 5th anniversary.
Amy Goodman, thank you for raising Winter Soldier, because I think this is a really extraordinary example of you know, one of the real weaknesses of our conventional journalism. So let me explain what that story is about.
I mean, it is just truly incredible. Hundreds of U.S. vets from Iraq and Afghanistan and some active duty soldiers gathered in the lead up to the 5th anniversary in March of the invasion, gathered at the National Labor College to talk about their experiences, to talk about the horrors of war, many testifying to atrocities they themselves had been involved with, and they had the video and photographic evidence to document what they were saying. So we got there early, Democracy Now! We cover stories like these quite a bit. We knew that this is any journalist's dream, right? You have you look for years for a soldier who's willing to talk, to explain their experiences, and this is hundreds of them. I mean, this was truly critical mass. So we wanted to make sure we were recording, that we were set up properly, that we were able to have access. But we didn't have anything to worry about because no one else was there of the media. Actually, that means we have a lot to worry about as Americans. Where was the media? This was the meat or the vegetables of any journalist. This is what you crave. This is not one of those pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. This was the real deal. These were the people themselves talking about their experiences on the battlefront. And the only newspaper that I saw, the Washington Post, in the metro section, did a story. Now, it was, yes, in their area. When you have a local story that has global implications, you put it on the front page. And where were the networks? Soldier after soldier got up. John Michael Turner, who now lives in Vermont, described his experience. He said, I had met him in Vermont before, and he said he was the one who told me about Winter Soldier, another reason why it's so good to get out there and report all over the country. You learn so much. And he said that would be the first time he would be testifying. But it is so important we hear from them. And I could see he was in a lot of pain. We had gone in Vermont to a human rights film festival. He was there to see The Valley of Elah, as we were, which is a very painful film about Iraq. And by the way, I really encourage people to see Phil Donahue's film, who was at the Media Reform Conference, Body of War. That is an absolutely critical film. I think when when it was shown, the place was packed out. Many were turned away. About 500 people came out to see Phil's film, and it's about a young soldier named Thomas Young, who on April 4th, 2004, the same day Casey Sheehan was killed, Cindy Sheehan's son, in Sadr City. In the same place in Sadr City, Thomas Young was blown up. He was paralyzed from the chest down, came back to this country and started speaking out against war. And he came to all over the United States to speak, although he's in a wheelchair. He needs dry ice to put on his body, off, on, off. He can't regulate his temperature. He came to a Brooklyn church, and he looked at everyone. He was hours late, and he started to put his head down on his knees because he was feeling weak. And then he looked up, he said, "Forgive me for stammering, forgive me for saying, forgive me for sounding presidential." Then he goes and meets Robert Byrd, the remarkable senator from West Virginia, talking about a man who has transformed. But he is the oldest senator. He's cast more than 18,000 votes, and he says his single most important vote was October 2002 when he joined 22 other senators. He led 22 senators in the charge against war. Unlike John Kerry, unlike John Edwards, unlike Hillary Clinton, he voted against war in the scene and the floor. And this is why it's so important we support independent media and have these films brought to movie theaters all over this country, because it will change you forever, and it can determine the course of this war when we pull out, when enough people see the images of war. Here was Senator Byrd in his office. Thomas Young visits him in his wheelchair. He brings out a framed list of what he called the honor roll, the 23 senators who voted against war, and he reads their names and has some trouble reading some of the names, and Thomas helps him. At the end, Senator Byrd turns to Thomas and says, "We thank you for your service, sir." And Thomas turns to Senator Byrd and says, "We thank you for yours." So I encourage people to have a body of war come out to Urbana-Champaign.
I saw that with you, Amy Goodman, and yeah, I agree. It was an extraordinarily moving film, and one everyone ought to see. Our guest today on Media Matters is Amy Goodman. You've been listening to her speak. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. We recorded this program shortly before going on air, so sit back, relax, let us do the talking today. Amy, you know, when your work is presented to people and it's well-received, at the same time, I have worked with you and with people, Democracy Now!, and people in various communities to try to get local public stations and community stations and television stations to carry Democracy Now! Periodically, I hear the refrain that, well, you know, you're a partisan journalist, that you're sort of not objective, not neutral, and that this is a problem. And I know this is a refrain you've heard. How do you respond to that?
Well, I have to say that the advocacy journalists who are my models are the corporate media. I mean, we know exactly what they think on every issue. They have no hesitation of expressing their point of view. And I don't think the issue is whether a journalist has a point of view. Everyone does. What matters is that we are fair and accurate in our reporting. And I think also the fact that President Bush did not find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq has changed everything for the media, because it exposed more than him. You know, if he had a little megaphone on the steps of the White House, he would have convinced some people, but he had something much more powerful. He had the most powerful institutions on earth. He had the U.S. press, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile. And when it turned out that there were not weapons of mass destruction, I think the American people said, "How did you get it so wrong?" Not just President Bush, but the media that amplified what he said, that convinced people day after day when the evidence wasn't there. And Democracy Now! Is bringing out the voices of those, not only in the conventional peace movement, but high level in military and intelligence, who are saying the evidence doesn't add up. And there were many people. But the corporate media iced them out. Now we've seen 5 years of them wringing their hands saying, "How did we get it so wrong?" And we encourage people, tune into the show that got it right, simply using principles of good journalism, going to where the story is, the people who are fighting the wars, the analysts who've looked at the evidence, not the know-nothing pundits. And then we see this whole scandal around the generals, that are, you know, hired by the Pentagon, fed propaganda, travel around, get tremendous access to the military, and they're the ones that are put on television on all of the networks. And you're not told that this man, for example, works for Blackwater, or this man works for DynCorp. And they are getting these jobs because they're guaranteed this access to the Pentagon. And in exchange, the Pentagon gives them their talking points, and they use the media. And now the FCC and Congress, for example, another of the participants in the Media Reform Conference was the North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan. And he has called, along with John Kerry and others, for an investigation into how these generals were used into the media being used as an arm of propaganda. There is something called the Smith-Mundt Act that was passed after World War II. When we saw the horror of a propagandized population, and that was the German population propagandized by the Nazis, that we in this country, in the United States, should not be propagandized by our national airwaves, the use of them. That, for example, you wouldn't be able to hear Voice of America in the United States because it was acknowledged as propaganda. It was okay for overseas, but not back here in the United States. And it is very important that the media not be used for propaganda because it is the way we make decisions about the most important issues on Earth. And the answer to you, Bob, a long answer to say, people realized, how did we get it so wrong? And now, more and more, they're turning to the media that got it right, which is why we just went on NPR in Baltimore. We're on a number of PBS stations around the country. I think people are hungry for independent voices. And I think it's no accident that we're building a new audience for public radio and television. There's been a great concern in NPR stations and in PBS, and you hear this at their national conferences of, you know, appealing to just one group of people, the predominant group, highly educated older white men. And how do you diversify the audience so it represents all of America? Well, Democracy Now! Is bringing in those audiences, younger audiences, diverse audiences. It's beating All Things Considered in Morning Edition and hands down in fundraising. People who are really committed because they realize the fate of the Earth is at stake in getting information. And that's why I think it's grown so much and why we work so hard. I work with a team of producers who are committed to going as close to the story as we can to find the people to tell their stories and to tell their stories if they can't tell them until they can tell their own.
Amy Goodman, you talked about the weapons of mass destruction really being a turning point for a lot of Americans or a moment of truth for them to see into the news media. And there have been mea culpas of sorts, modest ones at that, by some of the major news media, including the New York Times and Washington Post, for their coverage of the Iraq War, specifically the weapons of mass destruction issue. What is your take on how well the mainstream media have learned from the weapons of mass destruction scandal? And what's your take on how they're covering the Iraq War today? And what's missing if they're not doing a bang-up job?
I mean, the media has reached an all-time low. Even if some have acknowledged sort of to each other behind the scenes, or even in some small articles like the New York Times a couple years ago, page 810 in a box had the editors and Iraq and talked about how they got it so wrong. That's not enough. You need as many boxes on the front page of the newspaper as the articles that appeared there. That's what manufacturing consent is about. You know, you see something over and over and over again, it sinks into the consciousness of the American people. It's why a corrections box doesn't quite do it when you have a big front page piece that says the opposite, and then a few days later, you know, so what? You've got the correction. You do have to make it. But they didn't even name names. People like Judith Miller, people like Michael Gordon. You know, Judith Miller is out, but Michael Gordon's still there. And why does it matter? Because, yes, we have to deal with the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, but also the threatened war with Iran, which is astounding. Now, there's some crusading journalists who have written about this over and over, like Cy Hirsch, Seymour Hirsch of The New Yorker, who's made Iran his, you know, key issues are in a series of pieces. If the U.S. does not attack Iran or use a surrogate to do it, it doesn't necessarily mean that we were wrong, that there weren't plans to do it. It's because the American people are saying no. And the more they learn, the more they say no, and the stakes are so high. But when you see the same unsourced stories by the same reporters, like Michael Gordon, on the front page of the papers, alleging that Iran has weapons of mass destruction, you wonder, when is it going to change? And it's only going to come from media activism. I mean, you have George Bush knowing that there's the NIE, the National Intelligence Estimate, of the, I think it's the 16 top spy agencies in the United States that conclude Iran doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. That gets a story. But then you continue to quote those in power, like Cheney and Bush and Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, who keep alleging otherwise. And we need a media that continually is there, not just acting as a megaphone for those in power. It is unacceptable. I think the embedding process has brought the media to an all-time low. You know, reporters embedded in the front lines of troops. We saw that in Iraq. Well, that's going to give you one perspective. And reporters talk to each other coming back saying, oh, my God, you know, we eat with them, we sleep with them, our lives are in their hands. Of course we're not going to be critical of them. What about reporters embedded in the Iraqi hospitals and Iraqi communities and the peace movement around the world? And it's not just being embedded in the military. U.S. reporters are embedded in the establishment in this country. I mean, we're now getting a number of articles from journalists who are saying they could not raise difficult questions. You have Dan Rather. He was at the Media Reform Conference, who said, not in the U.S. media at the time, but on BBC, BBC Newsnight, he said, we can't ask tough questions in the United States because if we did, we'd be necklaced, referring to a practice in South Africa. This is very serious. A reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, an editorial page writer, just said the same thing. They couldn't do the stories that asked enough of the questions. And we see it on the networks, and it is unacceptable.
Our guest today,
our
guest today, Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, also the co-author of the brand new book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, which she co-authored with David Goodman. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters and WILL AM 580. Today's program is pre-recorded. We taped it shortly before going on air. So please don't call in. Let us do the talking today. Amy Goodman, one of the big domestic stories and actually global stories of 2008 has been that Barack Obama has won the Democratic nomination. And there's a great deal of debate about what exactly this means, and perhaps we won't know the answer for some time. But at the media conference that you and I attended in Minneapolis last month, Naomi Klein, in one of the main plenaries, issued a critique of Obama, saying, you know, let's not exaggerate what he stands for in terms of issues of war and peace and in terms of reform of the system. What is your assessment of the Obama campaign and Obama right now?
We have to, as journalists, ask serious questions. I just recently went on MSNBC on Chris Matthews' show Hardball. I was up against a right-wing radio pundit from Nevada. Our debate was on women voters, right? Because where do they stand? Well, I think that at this point, it's very hard to predict what will happen in November. You know, they're saying that the McCain campaign is trying to put out that there are these angry white women voters who, you know, supported Hillary. And he's been speaking very kindly about Hillary, as has Carly Fiorina, one of the only women, you know, in the inner circle of McCain's campaign, the former head of Hewlett-Packard, because they're trying to woo the independent women who supported, or whatever, independents, Democrats who supported Hillary Clinton to McCain. And I was saying, you know, it's very hard to judge at this point. We haven't even seen Hillary Clinton out on the campaign trail campaigning for Obama, and that can change a lot of things when she does that. But what we have to do is be honest in the records of these men. With McCain, it is not very well known that he has a zero rating when it comes to reproductive rights and women, right? He's 100% opposed to choice, to women determining whether or not they will have, for example, an abortion, or even voted against federal funding for family planning that included breast cancer screening. And because there hasn't been much focus on the record, and it's very important that we see this focus, that we just, you know, just the facts, man. Let us know what these men have represented and where they're going, who their advisors are. This is all very important. You had the scandal recently, Clayton Williams, right? Here is McCain, who's going to the home of the Texas oil man, and here is Clayton Williams, who had given the McCain campaign, I think, something like $300,000. Clayton Williams, who was famous in Texas for having compared rape to bad weather, saying, you know, it's inevitable. Since it's inevitable, you should just lay back and enjoy it. This is the same Clayton Williams, Texas oil man, who ran against Ann Richards in 1990 for governor. And he compared her to a cow, said that he planned to head her, huff her, and drag her through the dirt. Now, if you Google his name, these are the quotes you come up with right away. And this was the person who John McCain was going to have his fundraiser at and also take more money from him. And we have to know what the records are of the people around these people. That also applies to Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
You have Barack Obama recently castigating John McCain around the issue of Social Security, that John McCain would privatize Social Security. And yet, who are the top advisors of Barack Obama? It's very important to look at the people that he surrounds himself with. You have Jeffrey Liebman, who is the Harvard economist, who is a proponent of the partial privatization of Social Security. It doesn't mean that Barack Obama feels exactly the same way, but when you have an inner circle that supports this, you have to ask, what does he represent? Or more recently, the New York University scholar Furman, who wrote a piece about Walmart and about how progressive Walmart is. It's quite astonishing when you see what he has been saying. He said that this is the New York NYU scholar who is being brought on as a chief economic advisor for Obama, saying that the low prices trump the low wages, so they're good for Americans. Now, let's remember that Barack Obama rightfully criticized Hillary Clinton for her longtime, you know, membership on the board of Walmart. And now, who is he taking on to advise him?
And what about
these are questions that have to be asked.
And I think going directly to the issues you've been raising before in foreign policy, much of the Obama support has been driven by belief that you know, he's the anti-war candidate. He opposed the war in 2002 before the invasion. When we look closely at him, what do you make of his anti-war credentials?
Well, this is a key question. It's very important what he did in 2002. But then others will point out, once he came into the Senate, that his voting was almost indistinguishable from Hillary Clinton when it came to continued funding for the war. Now the question is withdrawal from Iraq, and what is the plan? I did question Barack Obama. He came to Cooper Union, this historic campus in New York, where Abraham Lincoln had spoken and others had, and he was talking about the economy, and so I got on the rope line, you know, where he's shaking hands with people, with our TV producer who had a camera, and I asked him, you know, what about withdrawal? He has refused to support a ban on mercenary companies like Blackwater in Iraq, and yet, you know, you still have Nisour Square massacre out there, 17 Iraqis killed by Blackwater operatives. Looks like a number of them have been granted immunity. They're getting more and more money, more and more contracts. What is Obama going to do about that? And Jeremy Scahill actually wrote an interesting piece for The Nation about this called Barack's Obama's mercenary position. And interestingly enough, as soon as he wrote the piece, well, this was in the height of the primaries, Hillary Clinton, though she had never been critical in any legislative way of the mercenary companies before, posted on the Hillary Clinton website that she would support a ban on these mercenaries. It's amazing what a little good journalism can do.
Yeah, it is.
Now the question is, will she carry it through? Because, you know, she's in a very good position right now to follow through on this. After all, she is a senator, one of the highest offices in the land. And that's another reason to ask these politicians questions, to make demands, not just use a campaign stop of theirs, which often they're coming through because they're holding a fundraiser somewhere, but not just use these rallies as an opportunity to get a snapshot. You know, we need that flashbulb of light to illuminate what the positions are. And when you can get a candidate to make a promise, there's no saying that he will absolutely follow through on it, but it makes him a little vulnerable. And this is an unbelievable moment of opportunity. These candidates want your votes. And so you can make demands, and constituencies should be doing this, from Social Security to war. What is Barack Obama's plan to end this war? That is a very serious question. And the more he's asked, the more he's pushed, the more pushback he'll feel when he's responding to the other side, which is also, you can be sure, making their demands. And it's not just a personal, private question asking of Obama. It's asking it publicly and giving others courage to ask those questions.
Amy Goodman, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Again, we recorded shortly before going on air, so please don't call in today. In June, Amy Goodman, Barack Obama gave a very controversial speech before AIPAC, the lobbying arm in the United States to promote support for right-wing policies in Israel. And it was a speech that was striking because it assumed a position that was even more militaristic than that of many Israelis, and more than any American politician in memory had ever stated. This is an issue that Democracy Now! And you have covered, I think, more than any other major news medium. I'm including you in major news media. What was your sense of that speech, and what's your sense generally of the coverage of Palestine-Israel issues in the U.S. news media?
I mean, it's an absolutely critical journal, critical issue. And as a Jewish journalist, I also feel a special responsibility because so often people are smeared, journalists are smeared with being anti-Semitic for being critical of the Israeli state. It is being critical of politics, how the state is carrying out policy. Now, I have covered Indonesia and East Timor for years, right? I covered Indonesia's occupation of East Timor, a small island nation 300 miles above Australia that suffered one of the worst slaughters of the 20th century, a third of the population wiped out. East Timor is now an independent country. The military regime of Indonesia committed the slaughter. It was supported by the United States. Now, when I'm doing this work and as I cover Indonesia, if someone said, I am being anti-Muslim, it's the largest Muslim country in the world, I would say religion has nothing to do with this. It has to do with the policies of the government of Indonesia, which happens, you know, it happens to be the largest Muslim country in the world. And I will say the same thing with Israel, that to be critical of the Israeli state is not to be anti-Semitic, and we have to stop that very damaging smear from being used against people who deeply care about human rights. I mean, after all, what about the Israeli peace movement? The Israeli Jewish activists who feel that the policies that are being chosen by the Israeli government are not helpful to the Israeli state, endanger the lives of Israelis. What about giving them voice? Journalists like Amira Haas, I recommend her work to everyone. Her mother survived the Holocaust. She's a Jewish reporter for Haaretz, the newspaper. Lived on the West Bank in Gaza for more than a decade, the only Israeli Jewish journalist to do that. Giving voice to people at the grassroots. I think everyone agrees there needs to be a solution. And this is why journalism is so important. Providing a forum for people to speak for themselves, to debate and discuss the most important issues of the day, to resolve problems, to fight stereotyping and caricatures, simply by letting people speak for themselves. So when you hear a Palestinian child or an Israeli grandmother, you say, it sounds like my mother, sounds like my aunt, sounds like my baby. And when you can start there, you're going to find a solution. And we need a media that stops erecting barriers as large as the separation barrier on the West Bank. That breaks down those barriers so we can arrive at a solution, so that the people there can arrive at a solution. They all must be heard. It should not be radical in this country simply to be able to broadcast a Palestinian voice. In fact, if we take the lives of Palestinians as seriously as we take the lives of Israelis, every Israeli life is invaluable as is every American life, as is every Palestinian life. And if we counted each Palestinian life as valuable, there would be fewer Israeli lives lost. That's why it is so important we resolve this, and the media is the place to do it. And the way it has to be done is by airing all sides.
Amy Goodman, our guest today on Media Matters. We've only got about 10 minutes left, Amy, and I'd like to change course for a second and ask you a question that's occurred to me and that friends of mine and colleagues have asked me to bring before you, which is, you know, I suspect if we're one to go back to the neighborhood you grew up in New York, or go back to your college classmates and look at what your friends and cohort are doing, not many of them are doing what you're doing. Where does your passion for social justice come from, and when did it arrive? Is it something you learned late in life, or early? I mean, what drives you, and where did it come from?
I think my family, my parents, my grandparents. My grandmother died a few years ago at the age of 108, and I was telling this story. A remarkable woman, a woman of three centuries, born in 1897, survived. Until just a few years ago, survived the pogroms of Europe and Russia, came to this country with my grandfather. My grandfather was an Orthodox rabbi. And my parents, my father was a doctor, very active in Physicians for Social Responsibility. He's the, looks sort of like Peter Sellers, and he was the person in the poster that all Long Island Railroad passengers saw. We grew up in Long Island in New York. It was a poster of a doctor with a white jacket and a stethoscope, and in that stethoscope was a mushroom cloud, and it said, "Your doctor is worried." That was my dad. Mm-hmm. My mom, also very active in the peace movement, and my dad led a task force when I was like in fifth grade to integrate the schools of our community. We sort of had de facto segregation based on where we lived, neighborhood schools, and he led a task force to integrate the school system so that we all went to school together, that the first grade and second grade was in one school, the third grade and fourth grade another, so we weren't divided by based on where we lived. And I watched as thousands shouting, screaming, angry people in a cafeteria or an auditorium of local school, how my father would navigate and try to arrive at a place that people could live with and to make the world a better place through that. And this had a tremendous impact on me, my brothers as well. I have three brothers, my brother David, who I've written the three books with, Exception to the Ruler, Static, and Now Standing Up to the Madness. He was my younger brother, but he started Dave's Press in our house. There were arrows up to his room. He was like 9 years old, and he would labor over this little Xerox machine. He would burn the image of the mimeograph into the next one, and he'd give out these little newspapers to our whole family. Actually, they were charged. It was like a cent a year, and I was in charge of subscriptions, which is why I think it's very important people support WILL. It's just in my blood from way back. And there was David. The letters to the editor was where we fought out the key issues of the day. Right, my grandfather would write in and say, "Dovital, you're so important to us, but we think that your view on Vietnam is wrong." And then David would write back to my grandfather, "Grandpa, you know, I love you. You are my first subscriber, but, you know, your views on war are stupid." And then my uncle would write in, and he would say, "Sal," to my grandfather, "how can you say this to your grandson?" And it would go from there. So I always saw the media as a place to work out these issues. In high school, I was editor of our high school newspaper, the Maroon Echo. And then it was holding our principal accountable, and then it was just moving to a larger stage, but always deeply caring about issues of social justice and how we can make the world a better place, all of us together. And I know none of us can do it alone. And the media is such a powerful force, and that there is nothing more compelling than hearing someone tell their story. And that is the that idea, also of journalists as storytellers, is the most important, I think, that is rarely talked about, is just allowing people to tell their stories or telling them when they can't, like so many men after 9/11 who have been detained, who've been rounded up, Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent. We have to tell their stories even if we don't know their names or the charges against them, until they can tell their own.
Amy Goodman, oftentimes journalists, commentators, intellectuals, citizens who are critical of U.S. foreign policy, as in Iraq or Latin America or Vietnam or Yugoslavia, are accused of being anti-American, being not patriotic. And that's doubly so when they are people committed to social justice, as you are. How do you deal with that charge when you get it, that you're not a real patriotic American because you're critical of the U.S. government and U.S. policies overseas?
Dissent is the highest form of patriotism. That is what will save us. That is why the Constitution is so important and we value it. And people who silence dissent have to be challenged. I mean, just recently you had a British journalist when Bush was in Britain with Gordon Brown sitting down with President Bush and Laura Bush. His name was Andrew Bolton. He was from British Sky News. And he asked him about the imprisonment of men at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and about extraordinary rendition. And basically Bush said he was slandering the United States. Dissent is the highest form of patriotism. We have to learn to think outside the box. The fate of the earth is at stake.
Our guest, Amy Goodman. This is Media Matters. Only got a minute or two left, Amy, and I just wanted to wrap up if I could. Looking forward, what are the big stories that our news media are really missing that you think, you know, Democracy Now! Wants to look at and will look at, but that needs just need a lot more attention that people, if they just consume the mainstream media, just won't be exposed to?
Well, I say war. And you might say, oh, my God, I mean, the media does cover Iraq. The media does cover Afghanistan. But it's showing the images of war. There is nothing more important. First of all, the coverage of Iraq and Afghanistan has gone way down. Media outlets are closing, foreign outlets are closing, offices all over the world, and that has to change. But just showing the images of war will change this country. There is no question in my mind. I often use the example of Mamie Till, the mother of Emmett Till, 1955, this 14-year-old boy is sent by his mother to Money, Mississippi, to be with family. He's lynched. He ends up in the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. Emmett Till is sent, his body, to Chicago, and his mother says she wants the world to see his face, that his casket should be open. She wants the world to see the ravages of racism and brutality of bigotry, and thousands stream by and see and remember. And then Jet Magazine and other black publications photograph Emmett Till, and the image is burned into the consciousness and history of this country. Mamie Till Mowgli had something very important to teach the press of today. Show the images. Show the pictures. If we, for just 1 week, saw those images in Iraq, we saw across our TV screens, on the front pages of every newspaper, the images of babies dead on the ground, of women with their legs blown off by cluster bombs, of journalists killed, of soldiers dead and dying. For just 1 week, Americans are a compassionate people, and they would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century.
On that note, Amy Goodman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you with us for the last hour.
Thanks, Bob, and I wish you the very best in all your future endeavors, and thank you for founding Free Press.
And I'm sure I'll be speaking to you again next time I've got the tin cup out.
Good. I look forward to it.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for arranging the show, Mike Pritchard for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney, back to you with a live show 1 week from today. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Sunshine and a possible wet start into the week is in the forecast for Champaign-Urbana and the area. Mostly sunny today and a high around 84. Southerly winds up to 10 miles an hour. A few clouds come in tonight, the low around 68. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. The high around 88 and a low around 70 degrees. Winds from the south up to 10 miles an hour. More showers and thunderstorms possible Tuesday and periods of sunshine. The high 87. This is WILL Urbana.
여기서